think it's on. Is it on?
Hello? Oh, man. It's working.
This is Ryan, also known as Woohoo Cthulhu on the forums, and I am a Game On minion.
D20 Radio, your gamer's role. www.d20radio.com.
Game On. Welcome back, Gamer Nation, to a very special episode of Game On. We've had a little trouble on our end of things, but we're back now for episode 27. I'm your host, Brian, known as Fiddleback on the forums, and with me today is, well, no one. That's right. Things have been kind of crappy on our end of stuff. Between my ISP being down for, well, who knows how long. And our schedules and all that kind of good stuff, which we've mentioned before. Andy, well, he's not here today. But that's okay, because he's here in spirit. Andy is such an integral part of the show, I can't just leave him out. So he will be represented by this sound. That's right. Andy's still here. Well, the best part, Andy. That makes it all okay, I'm sure. Yeah, we're going to try to wing this one. Just little old me, all by myself, doing my thing. It's a long, complicated explanation as to why we've been gone for the better part of a month or change, month and change, I suppose. But today's show is going to be a little off our norm, obviously. Since Andy isn't here, that gives me a chance to cover a topic we've been putting off for ages. That's right, CCGs. Oh dear.
Upkeep phase.
Well, it's not going to be a very big upkeep phase, mostly because I haven't really had a chance to see what's on the internet. I'm recording this show with no internet access as of right now, so I haven't been able to go and see what's on the forums, to see who's put out a new show or anything like that. I know there have been some new shows that have been introduced to the network. I'm sure they're excellent. And as soon as I have a chance to catch up with what's increasingly becoming a metric ass ton of shows that I've missed, I'll be happy to update you about all of them. In the meantime, I would like to say thanks to Woohoo Cthulhu for using our call-in line to leave us a voicemail for the bumper at the top of the show. Now, I'm sure you'd expect me to give you the phone number right at this moment in time, but the tiny yellow piece of paper I wrote it down on has disappeared amongst all the other tiny yellow pieces of paper scattered about my desk. So there is a phone number, and I know I've mentioned it on the forums, so you could probably find it there. But anyway, thanks to Woohoo Cthulhu for making use of the call-in line. And if you'd like to leave us a bumper, you can call in at, well, whatever that number is. Or you can record it and email it to us at gameon@d20radio.com.
Bits and pieces.
Well, in a similar thing to our upkeep phase, still don't have internet access because it's all of 30 seconds later. So there's news out there, I'm sure. But what I really wanted to do, and I wanted to make sure I covered this in this segment, is congratulate GM Chris and GM Dave on their ENI Awards win. That's a big step for the network, folks. That's a lot of exposure. That's really good stuff. And they do an excellent job over at the Order 66 and deserve every medal they get. So congratulations, boys. Keep up the good work. Boy, that went fast, didn't it?
Say, I'm looking for some sort of abstract strategy game, something with possibly parasitic conflict or bidding and economics. Something with majority control and mass marketing. Min-maxing that'll make people want to run away in fear not playing anything other than rock, paper, scissors. Have you got anything like that?
What the heck did he just say? Yes, we've returned to what did he say. Today we're talking about CCG, so I have a couple of definitions for you that will be useful to plug into your little brain pan there and reference as needed. The first definition is collectible. Containing components that require collecting through the expenditure of money or through trade with other players in order to acquire a complete set due to a random distribution scheme. See also trading. Definition numero dos. Living. Living card games have complete sets that are easily acquired through a single purchase. However, these sets are constantly updated with new releases which can be bought outright as well. Now, on with the show. Alright, so you've seen them hanging around your favorite local game store. Yes, they're usually about 10 or 12 years old. They're crowded around a table, and they have all these little things called cards in their hand. Sometimes they're for games you recognize, things you've heard of. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes the 12-year-olds are actually 30 or 40 years old. It's all very strange and confusing, and so I'm going to take some time to try to walk you through a few things about these collectible card games. Or are they trading card games? Or living card games? Or some other designation, like living collectible card games, or trading living games, or why do I care about these things games? Well, by and large, most of you don't, but some of you do. So we're talking to you that don't, trying to get you into that camp that you do, and talking to those of you who do, who can maybe try to understand those who don't. The first and largest aspect of collectible trading card games, or collectible card games, is the collectible aspect of it. The initial purchase looks very reasonable and fairly small. There's about 60 cards in a little box with the name of the game across the front, maybe some nice artwork on it, and a little story that tells you what the game is supposed to be all about. And that costs you maybe $10, maybe $15 at the outside. Okay? Easy, right? You buy one, you're ready to go. Not so much. That little initial investment will get you into a world of trouble if you're not extremely careful. One of the things that they like to do in these collectible and trading card game designations is build you kind of a mediocre starter deck. You know, it's enough to get a feel for the game, get an idea of how the thing plays. And after that, you sit down and you play a couple of games, you follow what appear to be some pretty esoteric rules. Sometimes they're easy to understand, sometimes they aren't. And then you try to play against somebody who's been at it for a while. And that doesn't really work very well. No, this guy, he's been around, so he's not spent just the $10 or $15 you did. He's now into several hundred dollars worth of investment. Why is that? Well, because the sneaky part of the game is that what you need to have a competitive deck, a deck that plays well against a variety of people, is more cards. And more cards is going to cost you quite a bit of money. The rest of the set, the part that you didn't get, is spread throughout these little packs called booster packs. And in each booster pack, you'll have maybe 6, 8, 10, 12 cards for the rest of the set. There's no guarantee what you're going to get inside this, because they're all random. It's a crapshoot trying to get what you want out of there. But they'll cost you about $5 a pop. and they will contain what they call commons, uncommons, rares, and in certain sets, ultra rares. What that refers to is how difficult it's going to be for you to collect those particular cards. Commons are, of course, everywhere. Like grass grown in your lawn. Then you have the uncommons, which are not quite as hard to get to as the rares, and not quite as common as the commons, but you'll still see them around everywhere. Probably the same ones over and over after about the first 6 or 8 packs. The rares are even harder to get. Typically, you get one rare in a pack. And the ultra rares, well, that's even worse. Ultra rares, you're lucky if you get one in every box. That's not box of cards, that's box of boosters of cards. Yes, they're that rare. In fact, I know some games that produce ultra rares that are literally one to a box, and you have to buy a complete box in order to get the ultra rare. Because if you don't, if you're foolish enough not to buy a complete box in one go, well, what happens to that ultra rare is your store owner gets it. Yeah, I know. It seems a bit unfair. So realistically speaking, what do you think your chances are of getting a full set of cards? Well, you might think that because there's 10 cards in a booster pack, and this happens to be, let's say, a 60-card set, that you can buy 6 boosters and be all done with it. Well, you're wrong, because the distribution is random. So the likelihood is, as we were saying, common cards, you will see quite a few of the same card over and over again, and not at all any of the ultra-rares that you need, or not enough of the rares that you need. So this makes it kind of problematic to get the entire set, which is where the trading aspect of these games comes in. If you have 900 copies of, let's say, Goblin Nose Picker, and your friend has 200 copies of the Goblin Toe Picker, well, then maybe what the two of you should do is get together and trade. You trade, say, you know, a few of your nose pickers for some of his toe pickers, and between the two of you, you manage to get what you need. Or the three of you, or the four of you, or, you know, maybe the five of you, or the six of you. Or the fact is, nobody has everything that you need if they're on any kind of reasonable spending budget. Now, having run game stores, Andy and I can both attest to the fact that there are those people who will come in as soon as a new set of cards is released for their favorite trading card game. They will come in and they will buy, somewhere in the order of 20 booster boxes, which contains about 36 booster packs apiece. Or they'll go on eBay and wait for somebody to collect the complete set and then offer it for sale themselves. Or any number of other schemes by which they acquire their cards. This is what we know as unreasonable expenditures. Frankly, if you've got anything like a regular job, and you have regular bills to pay, and you're not living on Mommy and Daddy's trust fund, you're stuck with the collecting and trading part of this game. And I'm sorry to say that's the way it's going to be. You cannot put that, at least I don't feel that you can put that kind of money into a trading card game and get every card you want. Now, having said that, there are some games I have managed to collect complete sets for. But your other difficulty is, if the game is really popular, you've got about 2 months to get a full set, either through trading or buying, before the next set comes out. And these expansion sets keep coming for the most popular games every 2 or 3 months, without fail. You never catch up. You are always behind. And this is one of the major drawbacks that Andy and I find in collectible or trading card games. You never catch up. You're never done. We are not financially independent. We are not living on trust funds. We have not won the lottery in a very, very long time. So we tend not to play a whole lot of collectible card games. In fact, Andy plays almost no collectible card games, which is essentially why I can do this episode without his input necessarily, because his is very limited. He has very limited experience with collectible card games. In fact, I think he's played all of 2 in the course of his long gaming career. So having said that, what is our alternative to the collectible or trading card game? Well, recently, Fantasy Flight Games came out with what they're calling a living card game. And the living card game idea is this. Yes, there are cards. Yes, there are expansion sets. But no, you are not going to have to trade or collect bunches and bunches and bunches of cards to get what you want. Instead, you will buy the entire expansion in one go. 45, maybe 50 cards to an expansion for about $10 for the entire set. Oh, I like this idea. Yeah, and in fact, Andy likes this idea too. We liked it so much we bought a game that was based around this idea. And it works pretty well. There's no quality difference, as far as we can tell, between the quality of play in a living card game and a collectible card game. But there is a huge quality difference in your ability to build decks and to enjoy the game when you're paired up against somebody who is maybe of a higher skill level than you. Because at least then, you're playing with skill. You're not worried about who has the better set of cards. So we kind of like the living card game idea. Now what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go through a list of the various collectible card games, living card games, trading card games that I've played over the years. And where I remember, I will indicate which ones Andy has had some experience and try to give you a general idea of his thoughts. And I'm going to take this in, well, some sort of mystical order that's not really clear to me right at the moment, but it starts with the first collectible card game I ever played. And that is a game called Doomtown. Doomtown is based on Deadlands, the RPG. And I know about half a Gamer Nation just went, ooh, tell me more. Well, you're operating in this little town, conveniently nicknamed Doomtown, and the idea of this game is that you are building the town, the various buildings in town, the various locations, the mines, and all sorts of other things, and then you're populating it with your gang. And there were a number of different factions, Law Dogs and Indians and Lost Souls and all kinds of stuff. And then you would go out into town and you would have a gunfight against other guys using the effects on the buildings and other structures, plus the effects on your guys, plus the effects on any weapons you happen to have, and fight a duel. And based on the cards that you drew out of your deck, you would form a poker hand, because every card indicated a suit and a rank on it. And the best poker hand would win that duel. Certain effects on cards gave you better draws, or the opportunity to redraw. And all in all, this was a really fun game. Things were powered by Ghost Rock. If you're familiar with the Deadlands milieu, you are familiar with what Ghost Rock is. And so you'd pay Ghost Rock out of your Ghost Rock mines to equip items or bring in people or build buildings. And on the whole, it was a really fun, kind of crazy game. This was the first one I played. This was kind of a mistake. Because Doomtown was way more complicated than I was ready to deal with in a collectible card game. Which is fine. Some people can get in on that curve. At that point, some people need to go down to a lower starting point on that curve. But that's all right. Because everybody's a little different. It was a fun game. I don't believe it's produced anymore. I know there was, at the time the game closed, that there was a movement afoot to get it picked up by somebody else and have them produce it, but I don't believe anything ever came of that. So yeah, Doomtown. Very fun little game. The next game I got into was a game called Warlord. This was produced by Alderac Entertainment Group, AEG, for those of you in the know. And Warlord is essentially D&D 3.0 3.5 rendered as a collectible card game. You would have your Warlord, and he would command troops, and you would be set in rank and file. And your troops would go against your opponent's troops. It was a straight-on attack. Cards added effects like magic and ranged attacks and, you know, various defenses and a variety of other things. And he who eventually killed the other player's warlord would win the game. And this, it's a fun, fast game. It uses a d20 as a randomizer, and stats on your cards indicate any modifications to the roll of the d20, and you rolled initiative each round, so the same person wasn't going to, first all the time, and you had a number of alternatives for the way, for the methods you built your army around, because everybody was a little bit different. In fact, I have a full sheet of cards here nailed to my wall, more or less. And I'm looking at it, and I see personalities, and I see items, and I see actions, and that kind of covers the entirety of the card varieties you had. And everything had a class and a skill and abilities of their own, and some could do ranged attacks, and some couldn't, and some were magicians, wizards, and some were thieves and rogues, some were barbarians, some were fighters. It really was a D20 game of Dungeons & Dragons rendered as a collectible card game. And I found it to be incredibly fun, so fun, in fact, that when I had my store, we hosted a couple of major tournaments, statewide, actually. And there were some very nice prizes for that, mostly extra rare or even beyond ultra rare cards, just cards you could only get by winning these particular tournaments. They were called Dragon Lord events, for those of you who might know. We hosted some Dragon Lord events. Next on the list of card games that I've been involved with is a game called Shadow Fist. This is based on the RPG, oddly enough, Feng Shui, or Funny Shoes, or whatever you choose to call it. And the idea here was much like Doomtown. You were kind of building your particular area of the world, and you would send guys in to attack your opponent's locations, try to control those, and eventually the game was decided by who controlled the most areas. But it's very much an action, Hong Kong action movie-style game. In other words, you've got a variety of genres represented, but they all fall under that same kung fu style that you get out of like John Woo movies or Jackie Chan movies or Jet Li movies or any one of a couple of hundred other styles of films and whatnot. And it ran the gamut from ancient martial artists to future tech, everything in between that. Some locations were in this world, some locations were on different planes, some locations didn't really even exist at all. And depending on how many resources you paid in off of your cards, you could bring guys and items and things into play and render some interesting effects. There was lots of one-on-one combat, and then there was lots of combat against these locations. And on the whole, the better you were at bringing in particular point values of guys, the better off you were going to be in the game, the more successful you would be, and more likely you would be to win. So the art in this, by the way, is absolutely amazing. It's pretty much everything you would want from a kung fu style game, rendered in some very nice art from a variety of artists. I know that's probably my biggest draw to the game is the quality of the artwork in it. Gameplay is good too. I enjoyed the gameplay. I didn't have any major problems with it. So again, this is a game that may or may not still be in print. Shadow Fist was produced by Z-Man Games. Not having the ability right now to go look and see, I believe you can still get it, and I believe that there are lots of sets available in toto on eBay and things like that, so it should be a fairly easy game to get a hold of if you're interested in doing so. Keeping on our Oriental theme here, I played a little bit of L5R, or Legend of the Five Rings, and this was more of an event-based game. This was, you would go to a particular location and do your combat. And I've only played L5R a couple of times, and it didn't really hit me in the right spot. But it is crazily popular. There are people who do nothing but play L5R and spend hours upon hours upon hours upon hours tuning decks and participating in tournaments. And they do have some really interesting tournaments. I've seen sword tournaments where the prizes are actual swords. I've seen a whole bunch of different kinds. It's a little bit, to my mind anyway, it's a little bit thick rule-wise. It tends to get overly complicated, and strange things happen, not because of the mechanics on the cards or the way you built your deck, but just because of the way the rules are written. So, you know, this one I would put up in the more complicated, more experienced player realm. It's got to be something that you definitely are interested in. You wouldn't really want to dabble in it, because it's a little hard to get to grips with just right off the bat. I'm going to skip down the list a little bit, because I'm sure hundreds of you are out there screaming at your computers or your iPods, "What about Magic?" To which I say to you, what about Magic? Yes, it's the one that started the whole thing. Okay, so we owe the entire collectible card game craze to Magic. Having said that, I think it's a game that's seen its prime. Don't get me wrong, lots of people still play it. Probably more than any other card game I would be mentioning today. But I don't know. I got into it kind of late. I got into it only because I had my store, and I felt that I needed to at least understand how the game was played in order to be able to carry the product and carry it effectively. Magic is pretty simple. You bring in resources, or mana, as they like to call it. You pay for what you want to bring in creature-wise with this mana, and you attack your opponent with your creatures. Either you attack his creatures, or you attack him directly. Your opponent then has an opportunity to block these things, and then the higher point value kills the lower point value, and I don't know. It's okay, I suppose, if you're just getting into CCGs and you're trying to figure out how it all works and why it's popular and all that. But this Magic is really guilty of that whole 2-month new set thing I was telling you about earlier. About the time you think you finally got yourself caught up, a new set comes out and you're behind again. Not to mention the fact that if you're getting into it at this point, you have got a ton of old sets to worry about. Because yes, while only certain ones are tournament legal, and they tend to be the most recent ones, you're not going to see just the recent stuff. You're going to see lots of old stuff from sets you've never heard of in casual play. And casual play is where you're going to learn the game. And somebody who has a really well-tuned deck can do severe damage to your ego and your desire to continue playing this game. So take Magic with a grain of salt, I would say, at this point. Be aware that it is not the be-all and end-all of collectible card games. And as such, it's okay, I suppose, to check it out. You know, borrow some decks from people, play around with it a little bit, see what it's like. And then don't feel bad if you decide that, you're going to put this one back down and never see it again. Also, there tends to be another barrier to entry with Magic, and that is the fact that everybody you're likely to run into who plays Magic has been playing it a very long time, and there isn't really a rule book that's handy and available to you. Yes, you can go online and download the 140-page rule book, but why would you? Well, you would have to do that because not everybody's going to be able to explain all the rules anymore. And not all the people you're going to be playing against are going to be happy to share those rules with you. So there's going to be a lot of research on your part to figure out what you can do and what you can't do and how the game is really supposed to be played. And believe me, you're going to want to do this eventually because you will get whipped so badly that you will be absolutely certain that there is something broken about the game as a whole. And what you'll find out is when you go online and you look through the rule book and all that is that the people you're playing with are actually playing some sort of mutated version of Magic that bears little to no resemblance to anything that is as it should be. So, yeah, you do yourself a favor. It's kind of like the monopoly of collectible card games at this point, where everybody thinks they know the rules, but they're not actually playing by the rules as written. So, yeah, if you get into Magic, be prepared for that little effect. The next game I want to talk about is a game that is probably the most recent CCG that I got sucked into, and I have to thank Andy and his partner in the store for this, and that is a game called Maple Story. Now, for those of you who are unaware, there is a Korean game called Maple Story, a Korean computer game called Maple Story, where, as near as I can figure, the object of the game is to absolutely wear out your clicking finger, clicking on things. You click and you click, 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 for hours on end. I know this to be true because Andy now has an index finger on his right hand that is some half an inch shorter than his index finger on his left hand due to all the clicking this man spent over the course of about 4 weeks. Fortunately, I was able to realize that this clicking was getting me nowhere within 2 or 3 days of playing it, and got out of it. Andy took a little longer than that, though. The Maple Story card game is okay, I guess. I referred to it as Warlord Light. Although it doesn't bear any resemblance to the D&D rules or anything like that, it does have a very similar idea, which is that you control one main character, and you can bring in, albeit temporarily, some subservient characters, and you kit things out with, you know, gear and effects, and action cards assist you, and then you basically run screaming at your opponent's character and try to stab, shoot, or magic him to death. Yeah, it was okay for about 20 minutes, and then it was not okay for quite a long time after that. There were some interesting aspects to it in that in the packs of cards you bought, you would often get cards that had codes on them, and you could take those codes to the video game, the computer game, and redeem them there for special bits and pieces and whatnot. Although this did not work in reverse, you weren't about to get codes in the video game that helped you out with the card game. It's got cutesy, cartoony kind of art. And that's okay if you like that thing, and again, I liked it for about 10 minutes, and then decided, okay, that's enough for me. So, I don't know if it's still running high in popularity or not. It was for a while there. People were all over it. And, I don't know. If you have a chance, check it out. It might be the kind of thing you like. It's pretty basic, pretty simple stuff. So, yeah, Maple Story. Woo! Around about the same time as Maple Story, we also checked out the World of Warcraft card game, which was some crazy combination of magic and warlord and stuff like that. Again, one big guy, you kit him out, you have some helpers, and you go screaming and stabbing and magicking and shooting your opponents to death, or attempting to, at least. I have to say the art did virtually nothing for me. The gameplay was just too similar to other stuff that I had played, and it held essentially nothing new while being equally as tedious as things that were already out there. That's really the pocket review of the World of Warcraft trading card game. I'm sorry if you like it. I'm sure you're allowed to. It's just not my bag of tea. Now, sadly, and perhaps somewhat surprisingly, I have played 2 games of the Yu-Gi-Oh! Card game. First drawback, odd-sized cards. They've got them now, but when it first came out, you couldn't find sleeves that fit those cards appropriately. So, I'm kind of in the school that says, you know, since these things do have a secondary market value, it might be a good idea to try to protect them as much as you possibly can while you play, just on the off chance you want to get out of the game and then unload all the stuff. Its other drawback was that it quickly became apparent to me that this was nothing more than an exercise in math. Not that number against number was what you were looking at. It was just the scoring was ridiculous. There's no reason in the world to have cards that have 5,000 points worth of life and do 250 points worth of damage to them. There just isn't any point to that, as far as I'm concerned. Knock off a couple of zeros, and maybe we'll be talking. But I really don't need to sit there and figure out what 4,870 minus 273 was. I don't enjoy that kind of tedious little math thing. And the art's not that great as far as I'm concerned. And the fact that you're playing with 8-year-olds is also not that great. However, it's a simple game. And an entry point into the collectible card games, if you want it that way. I don't know. Yu-Gi-Oh! It was too simple for me, and yet too mathy. Too much math involved in it. Too much ridiculous math. But again, you bring monsters into play, kind of like Magic, and you bring spells and abilities into play, and your opponent tries to reduce your life points down to zero before he gets his reduced down to zero. And really, the game technically seems to come out to who can lose the last 100 points that they have first. All those other thousands of points are absolutely meaningless until you get down to the last 100 or so. And then it gets kind of hairy. In a similar vein, I have played Pokemon once or twice. Again, cutesy art. I'm not that excited about it. Too much coin flipping for me, as far as I could tell. Very limited interest if you're over the age, again, of 8. But if you got a kid, or you really want an easy entry point, maybe that's the way to go for you. Although, if you're an adult over the age of 25 and you're still playing Pokemon or Yu-Gi-Oh!, perhaps it's time to re-examine your life. Okay, so let's talk about some other ones, some more complex things. For a while there, back, I guess it was early 2000 or so, there was a game called NFL Showdown, which combined, supposedly, and you can put air quotes around this, the best aspects of collectible sports cards and trading card games. You got, in NFL Showdown, you got a variety of cards representing the players and the plays, and you also got this thing which we referred to as the Bleep Bloop. It was an electronic device which you would use to scan your cards, because every card had a barcode on it. So you would, for example, scan your defensive play and the person you wanted to execute that defensive play, and then your opponent would scan his offensive play and the person he wanted to execute the offensive play, and the Bleep Bloop would do some magical thinking inside and tell you what the result was, whether you gained yardage, lost the ball, or whatever. And then you would mark your advancements on the paper mat, and that was all well and good, except for one very fatal flaw. When NFL Showdown came out for that first year, the Bleep Bloop did not work on the rare cards at all. The reason for this was that the rare cards were foil rares. In other words, they had kind of a shiny foil coating over them. And the little laser beam or red eye or whatever it is that was supposed to read the barcodes couldn't read it with all the flashback from the foil coating. So you would have your rare cards, which were totally unusable. That made the game rather difficult to play with any sort of quality. Eventually, we figured out you could photocopy the dumb things, and it would read the photocopy just fine. But that, by then, was the bloom was off the rose at that point. It also didn't help that a couple of the guys in the league that we were playing in figured out that on certain plays, with certain players, it didn't matter what the defensive strategy was. These players would always produce a favorable result on these plays. So those became the only plays they used and the only players they used, which essentially made them unstoppable. Now, it's my understanding in subsequent editions of the game, they fixed the Bleep Bloop and they fixed the predictability of the plays, but by then it was all over and done with as far as we were concerned. The game just didn't work and wasn't any fun. So we stopped playing that after the first season. Along with that, about the same time, we got into Major League Baseball Showdown. Same concept. There was no Bleep Bloop this time. This was literally a chart reference collectible card game. There would be a chart on each character, on each player, whatever. Character, player, call them the same thing. And you would refer to this chart, and your opponent would refer to his chart during batting or whatever. And you would compare results and roll the dice and refer to another chart. And that would tell you whether or not you hit the ball, how many bases you got, and that kind of stuff. And you would essentially play it that way. It was all right for a while. We got to the point where we were just playing booster draft teams. In other words, you'd buy a booster box and maybe a starter box and draft out the players you wanted. But inevitably, this ended up with, somebody ending up with a bunch of crappy guys. So, let's see here. What else have I played? I've played Star Wars, a collectible card game. Not the old one. Not the Decipher version. But the one that came out with, I think it was about the same time as Episode 2 was getting ready to release in the theaters. The idea here was that you were fighting three separate arenas. You would fight in space, you would fight on the ground, and then you would fight personal battles. So naturally everybody had cards that were, you know, space, ground, or personal. The personals featured, you know, the named characters like Boba Fett or Luke Skywalker or Darth Vader. Actually, I take that back. It didn't have the original trilogy guys. It had all the new guys. It had Anakin and Jango Fett and Count Dooku and stuff like that. And then, of course, the ground had the ground assault vehicles like the AT-STs and the... No, AT-TEs and the spider droids and that kind of stuff. And then, of course, space had Jedi starfighters and Star Destroyers and things like that. And the object of the game was to win two of the three arenas, and then you would win the game. And you would have combat going on. Your opponent would lay down guys, you'd lay down guys. They'd duke it out using the numbers on the cards, and you could apply effects and things like that. And it was okay, but there was some thought that maybe this could have been thought out a little bit better and had some more interesting mechanics than what it was going on. Yeah, anyway, the Star Wars card game from Wizards of the Coast was okay. It wasn't great, wasn't horrible, it was just kind of okay. And last but not least was the Lord of the Rings card game from Decipher, which came out with the movies and featured the absolutely gorgeous artwork from the movies. They were literally stills taken from the films and incorporated into the cards. And this one was really cool. And I'm sorry I didn't get to play this more. But the problem we had was there was only myself and one other guy who were interested in the game. And eventually, after about the fifth or sixth time, we got tired of playing against each other. And we're looking for more opponents, and that didn't materialize. But the idea was that you were actually trying to get... Well, it was kind of complicated. When you built your deck, you built both good guys and bad guys into your deck. Because what would happen is you would lay out this path of cards. And there were, I believe, seven cards, each one featuring a different location from the movies. And you would try to progress down this path to the end. Your opponent, while you were trying to run your fellowship down this path, your opponent would be playing the bad guys you had to face. While he was trying to run his fellowship down the path, you would play the bad guys he had to face. And this worked in kind of an interesting way, because every time you brought in a member of your fellowship, or you brought in a special effect, or you brought in some equipment or something, you had to pay points into a pool of points. And then your opponent, when he was putting the bad guys up against you, would spend the points you put into the pool to bring out bad guys to block you from moving down the path. And this would go back and forth until your ring bearer was killed. And whoever lost their ring bearer first lost the game. The alternate victory condition was if you were the first one to get to the end of the path, you won the game as well. So there was a lot of incentive to kind of manage very tightly what you needed to bring into play in order to be successful versus what you allowed your opponent to use points-wise to try to stop you. And you could push yourself down the path. Normally you would only move one location at a time, but you could push down the path, but that meant that your opponent had more points to stop you with. So it was a very tight balancing act between what you could do and what you were allowing your opponent to do. The deck building was a very tight little balance between having enough good effects and good guys to get you to the end and having enough bad guys to stop your opponent. And it was really an exceptionally well done trading card game. And I think if I could have gotten more people interested in playing it, I'd probably still be playing it today, even though I believe this Decipher has well and truly stopped producing it. But yeah, it came out with a new set every few months, all through the release of the movies, and then even past the release of the movies, where they went back to, for example, Weta Workshop, which did all the costuming and effects and whatnot, and had them remake some of the costumes or reimagine some of the characters and whatnot. And so they produced a whole bunch of new stills and stuff. There's even a Tom Bombadil card with a guy kitted out as Tom Bombadil, courtesy of Weta Workshop. And all kinds of neat stuff they did with that game. They were gorgeous cards and a really, really nice gameplay mechanic that made it all worth doing. Now, so far, every game I've talked about has been either a collectible or a trading card game. And the absolute last game I want to cover here is one of the living card games from Fantasy Flight Games, and that's the Call of Cthulhu game. Now, I know here a couple episodes ago, Andy and I had talked about playing that game in our On the Table segment, and since then, we haven't gotten to play it again, but I just want to emphasize the true nicety of being able to buy a complete set of cards for a game and not having to worry about not having all the cards available to you. The booster packs for this thing are $10, at least at my local gaming store. And the game plays really well. You're trying to win stories while your opponent is trying to prevent you from winning stories. And if you win 3 stories, you win the game. And there's a number of different abilities which you compete against your opponent with. And whoever has the stronger of those abilities in play at the moment wins that ability fight. You complete all the fights on the abilities available to you, and then whoever won the most of those gets the story, essentially. If you want a more detailed review of it, then listen back a couple episodes to the I think it's our second episode dealing with our Star Wars campaign. So that's kind of a basic overview of the various CCGs I've had an opportunity to play. There's probably a couple hundred thousand more out there because everybody pretty much decided that was a big moneymaker as soon as Magic took off. They're varying qualities. You know, through experience and trying things out, you'll come to find ones you like and ones you don't like, and some are more complicated than others. But hopefully this has given you a lead on a few that I enjoyed. Admittedly, a number of them are out of print, but there's no better CCG to buy than the one that's cheap on eBay. So give those a try. If you're interested in these, as I said, look around on eBay. Sometimes you can find people selling sets on Craigslist or even individual rares or uncommons and things like that in your favorite local game store. Most game stores have some sort of supply of individual cards. And you know, check it out if you haven't before. Check it out slowly. Get yourself a starter deck. Play against somebody else who has a starter deck. Don't dive in and think you're going to be competitive against somebody who's been in the game for a while and has access to lots of cards. That's just not going to happen. They can be fun. They can be interesting. They're a reasonable social opportunity for meeting new people who are interested in not only CCGs but other games as well. You can find a lot of contacts for building a game group through CCGs as well, because people tend to have more than one interest, unless they're the the very young or the somewhat more mature gamer, if you're still playing, you know, Yu-Gi-Oh or Pokemon or, you know, some of these others in your 30s, nothing against you personally, but these people tend to be one game guys. In other words, that's the only thing they play. And especially the younger kids as well. And if you don't mind playing against younger kids, that's fine. They can be somewhat challenging at times. And in fact, I remember a Yu-Gi-Oh tournament we had at our store. I don't know, probably one of the biggest Yu-Gi-Oh tournaments we'd had. We had somewhere around 50 or 60 people show up for it. And this kid had come into town from somewhere out in the boonies. And his only experience playing Yu-Gi-Oh was watching the cartoon on TV. And he was more than happy to say he knew everything he needed to know about the game from watching the cartoon. And this turned out, of course, to be not the case. But he did do a wonderful impression of exactly how they bring cards into the game in the cartoon. Much to the aggravation of those around him, he would stand up from his chair, shout the loud announcement, and then slam the card down on the table. And it was, you know, funny to watch for about 10 minutes, and then it got annoying. So I don't know why I told that story. But I did. Anyway, collectible card games. Give them a chance. I know nobody wants to get invested that deeply, but try a few of them on the cheap and see what you think. They can be a fair amount of fun.
Join us now as we enter a world that many think doesn't exist. A world of strange sights, strange sounds, and pleasant scents. Come with us to That's What She Said.
Hey, this is Kat, and I love game days, which is basically what I call spending a whole day at the table with a group of like-minded individuals. You can play board games, card games, RPG, whatever you feel like and have on hand. I've become rather spoiled lately. In the last few weeks, I've had no less than 4 game days, and even better. 2 of them have been at Reaper, home of ReaperCon, The Asylum, and Minis Galore. The nice thing about game days is they can be as easy or as complicated as you like. Everyone can pitch in by bringing snacks, planning a game, hosting it, whatever they feel like they can contribute. They're a great excuse to try out new games and hang out with your friends, or make new ones. I can't wait till next time.
Well, obviously Kat sent that in quite a while ago, after going to ReaperCon. And she has since been to Gen Con, and I wonder how she feels about game days now. But, game days are really nice. We used to do, when I was much younger, all-night sessions where 4 or 5 of us would sit around and we'd play Catan for hours on end. We'd finish one game and start another. I think there was one night where we played Catan like 6 times in a row. And that was pretty much the capper. Game days are great. I love it when I can get one and get together with a bunch of people and kind of enjoy the company. What do you think, Andy? Okay, thanks.
On the table.
Well, you might think this on the table is going to be a little lame, but you're right. No, I can't deny it. Things have not been going well, schedule-wise, in terms of getting games played and whatnot, so I've been trying to squeeze them in where I can. I did, a week ago, get to play 221B Baker Street with Andy and some of the kids at work. We talked about me finding this here a while back, and we've discovered this game has a couple of little problems. One of them is, first off, the premise of the game is that you're given a case, and just the basics of it, and you are supposed to go around Victorian London discovering the clues you need to solve the case, generally providing answers to the who, the what, the why, the where, and the when. Motives and things like that. And the first problem with this game is it's actually a fairly large board with quite a number of spaces on it. And you are meant to move around this board by the use of one, count them, one six-sided die. Andy and I tend to roll a lot of ones when things like that are important. And so progress around this board was not very fast and served primarily to lengthen the game beyond a reasonable expectation of the time commitment involved. We've decided that if we play this game in the future, we are going to use two six-sided die in the hopes of speeding things up a little bit. Because just kind of putt-putting around the board just makes it long and kind of tedious to get anywhere. The second problem we discovered is that while every location provides a clue of some sort, and admittedly some of them are kind of, you know, red herrings, but while every location provides a clue of some sort, even if you have all the clues available to you all over the table, you still don't have everything you need to solve the case. I don't know why this should be the case. For example, the one we were working on was some guy was getting 20 bucks sent to him in the mail with a stipulation that he had to give half of it to somebody else. And the notes that accompany these would specify who he had to give them to, where he would find them, things like that. And unfortunately what happens is the last person he has to give the money to turns up dead the next day. And it's up to you as Sherlock Holmes to figure out why this happened and who did it. What it comes down to is that this guy's brother is laundering counterfeit money, and his girlfriend decides that she wants in on it, so she's trying to extort some money out of him. And anyway, the point being, you don't find out about the extortion by collecting clues, and it's not mentioned in the story in any way that makes any sense. So your motive is never completely filled in on this particular case. And I don't know if it's just the one case that's like that, or if they all have some element like that, where you're essentially having to make a blind guess is about some aspect of the case. But nobody won the game because nobody got it right. And you have to get all the required questions answered. And since one of them was motive, it didn't work out right. We played, and this game's only supposed to take like 45 minutes. We ended up, of course, playing for 2 hours. And that just kind of made things drag along, and it wasn't as enjoyable as we had hoped it would be. We're hoping the addition of the extra die makes a difference, speeds things up, makes it a little more fun, a little more fast-paced, a little more crucial to get to locations before other people. Because as it was just a leisurely stroll around London, stopping at these locations, getting the clue, and then moving on. So, 221B Baker Street. We'll see. We're going to give this another play at some point and see how it works out. But as of right now, this is not on our favorite list. All right, well, here we come to the end of an unusual show of Game On. And like always, we tried to avoid it for as long as we possibly could, and that turns out to be, you know, a little over an hour. I don't have a whole lot for back chat other than to say that at this present moment, and this is, let me see here, this is August 23rd at about 1 in the afternoon that I'm recording this. At the present moment, I still am without internet. So, when you get this show, be aware that means I've probably got my internet back at some point. But it's been a long dry spell here. There's been about a month of no internet, no word, no contact. I have to go places to actually get internet. And one of the things is that we had a lightning storm here about a month ago, and it knocked out ever so briefly. I mean, it was just a little flicker. But it knocked out the internet for this entire complex of apartments I'm living in. Since then, I have been hounding the internet company that provides the service, and I've been getting nowhere. I'm told every other apartment in the complex has their internet back and has since the Tuesday following that storm, almost a month ago. I'm the only one without. And they claim, variously, that they're either working on it, or it's fixed, and they don't know why I'm having a problem, and all that stuff. So I'm really out of touch with Gamer Nation. For the past month, I don't know, really. I manage every once in a while to find a connection and get, you know, get on from, like, work or... But I work or the, you know, parents' house or whatever. But I really can't invest the time I need to keep up with all you guys and answer questions and, you know, check in on the blogs and the boards and all that stuff and see what's going on. So I'm kind of flying blind here. But I hope you've enjoyed this show in some way, and I hope you continue to patiently await further episodes. The couple of times I've been able to check FeedBurner, our numbers seem to be holding pretty steady, but I don't know how long that's going to last without a new episode coming up. So, you know, get the word out, let people know that we're still around and we're still trying, and if you'd like to contact us, Andy when he's around, and me whenever, you can do so by email at gameon@d20radio.com. You can visit the forums at www.d20radio.com/forum. You can check out our blog, and I want to thank Woohoo Cthulhu and Kat for helping out with that. Our blog is at www.d20radio.com/gameon. And there is a phone number, as I mentioned earlier, that you can call us at, and as soon as I can remember what that phone number is and track it down and give it out to you, I will. I know it's up on the webpage or up on the forum somewhere, so, you know, look around for it if you really want to call us and drop us a bumper or whatever. But that's our show for today, and thanks for sticking around and still listening, and I hope we'll be back to normal in a short amount of time. But at the present rate of progress, I might be flying these in by carrier pigeon. Which, being that they're extinct, might make this a little more difficult, but I'm sure it'll be faster. So until next time, Gamer Nation, game on.
This podcast is intended for entertainment and educational purposes only. All specific names, titles, or products mentioned are copyrighted by the respective rights holders. Some sounds and music are provided courtesy of SoundSnap.com and Freesound.org. Reboot is copyright Alliance Entertainment. All original content of this podcast and its related website are intellectual property of Game On and D20 Radio.
Roll.